offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai being joined along with Arvind, and we are welcoming you to yet another episode of our afternoon satsang. And if you followed us last week and all through our satsangs, you'll know that we are in the middle of our Satyam Shivam Sundaram episodes, and we are talking about the 1948 events that happened in that year. And the most standout event was the purchase of the land on which stands the Prashanta Nilayam Ashram, and how Swami went about beginning the construction of the Mandir. But before we get into all that and much more, let me join you all in welcoming Arvind. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, I'm overwhelmed by this very warm welcome. Yes, offering my most humble salutations and gratitude at the lotus feet of our dear Swami. We will dive into 1948. You know, so many things happened in 1948, as they have happened in every year that the Avatar was on Earth. But in the background, the construction of the Mandir went on. And so, now you will see that as we relive the beautiful episodes of 1948, it will seem as if the construction of the Mandir is forgotten. It is not. It is just that it went on in the background relentlessly for a few years before it was actually inaugurated in 1950. So we have to keep in mind that the most important incident or event as far as history of the Avatar is concerned in 1948 is the beginning of the construction of the Prashanta Nilayam as we know it today. But we will not be talking much about it in this satsang, because that is going on in the background, while in the foreground so many things happen.
And it's also 1948. Had it been 1990 or later, the construction of the Mandir would have happened in 6 months. Seeing how it happened with the hospital and the other buildings.
In fact, the Satya Sai Indoor Stadium, the International Sports Center Indoor, I think it was built in about 128 days.
Right.
And I remember I was a student in the hostel then, and every day as we would walk out for darshan, we would see one big board placed right at the entrance, the main gate of this building being constructed, and there was this notice showing that 120 days to go, 119 days to go. So it was literally a countdown, and it was miraculous, you know, as if it is a building built of Lego blocks. It looked like that, because the huge massive building came up in less than 3 to 4 months time.
But you know, having said that, a wonder of what it was in the initial days, coming up in a place like Prashanta Nilayam in that span of even 2 years, in 48, Swami starts the construction, foundation stone is laid. In 2 years to have the building absolutely ready and Swami moves in, that itself was phenomenal, you know, for the description we hear of Prashanta Nilayam in those days.
Absolutely, it was unimaginable to even get some of the bulldozers, earth movers and other construction equipment that were necessary. And let us remember it, this was about 60 to 70 years ago, 65 years ago to be precise. And that was a time when construction equipment had not made such progress also. In fact, if we see the indoor stadium, we were talking about it. It has been constructed with a special kind of quick drying concrete. Okay. Can you believe it? A concrete that dries up and sets within 24 hours. And therefore, yes, and that was the reason why they could proceed at that breakneck speed. And in fact, the whole roof was prefabricated and made and kept ready. And literally like a Lego block, it was lifted and placed upon top. So, they could do a kind of parallel processing, and that's why they achieved it in record time. None of these techniques were, had been discovered yet, because there was not enough technology to support such techniques. And even if technology was there to some extent, it was remotely possible, it was not even remotely possible for such technology to reach a remote place like Puttaparthi. And therefore, we can confidently say that the fact that the whole Mandir came up in 2 years is definitely a miracle in itself.
And that's true. You know, once I was talking to a friend of my father, and he worked for the L&T. And he was once sharing with us that there was a point when there was a nationwide strike. I think all the trucks were off the road or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He said construction had stopped in all sites of L&T except in Prashanta Nilayam.
Oh. Larsen and Toubro. Huh.
Yes, he said only in Prashantanilayam it was going on because some devotee was ready to offer his trucks for Swami's service.
Wow.
When every other person's trucks were off the road.
That's amazing. You know, it is amazing in a sense, and in the other sense it doesn't seem amazing, because if God cannot do it, who else can? That is the question, and God naturally achieves everything. Talking of constructions, in 1948, apart from the Prashantanilayam Mandir, Swami also laid the foundation stone for a public park and radio house at Bukapatnam.
That's a very interesting concept. I think people of our age and generation will not cannot understand that, because we carry a radio in our pocket.
I mean, radio itself is outdated.
Yes, radio itself is outdated, and the only radio we have a contact with is maybe the FM radio, which is very popular in the cities.
And Radio Sai,
yeah? Yeah, of course. You know, yeah, internet radio. That's what I was trying to say, that, you know, you can carry a gadget like a phone or something in your pocket, and which can connect you to 1,000 radio stations.
Hmm.
But in that time, imagine they couldn't afford a radio, so they would have what is called a radio park. And in fact, if you listen to some of Venkatraman's musings, he says that's where they used to go and listen to the radio.
A radio house that would be built.
Right. Either a radio house or in a public park, they would have two huge horn speakers
which connected,
connected to a radio. And they would have fixed times for the news. So they would walk to the evening in the park, and that's where they would sit and listen to the news.
Wow, it was more...
Especially because it was the, you know, the time of independence and...
Indian nationalism was on its rise. Yes. So, Swami laid the foundation stone for this park, which was inaugurated an year later, on the 5th of May 1949, by none other than Neelam Sanjeeva Reddy, who later on, I think in somewhere in the mid-1950s, went on to become the chief minister of the state of Andhra Pradesh. He won two terms as the chief minister of the state, and later on became even the president of the Indian nation.
Right. In fact, so, if you recall, when you were talking to Mr. Nagaraju from the Anantapur, he was telling that even when Neelam Sanjeeva Reddy came home, he was not allowed inside the house.
Because he was of a lower caste.
Because of a lower caste. But Swami was allowed, and he was sitting in the living room. That's
yes.
What he had said. So reference was made to him during that conversation.
So Neelam Sanjeeva Reddy was a staunch follower and devotee of Bhagwan. And yes, so he was the one who inaugurated that public park and radio house. And reading about which, Prema, I really have this curiosity. I am very eager. I have been to Bukapatnam several times. I don't seem to have seen this. I hope it is still there, because I have seen the photograph in the book of the foundation stone, which says that foundation stone laid by Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba in 1948. So I just hope that the park is still there, and maybe we can visit it sometime. And if we find it, we can broadcast it on the radio, so all our listeners, when they visit Prashantanilayam, can visit this park, the foundation stone of which was laid by Swami.
Definitely.
The public park and radio house at Bukapatnam.
In fact, you know, some of these inaugurations, especially this park and few other things in Bukapatnam, it was not just that Swami went and laid a foundation stone. In fact, this park which we're talking about, I think Swami didn't go for the inauguration. He went for the foundation stone. The inauguration was, as you mentioned, was done by Neelam Sanjeeva Reddy. But the interesting thing is the background work which was going on for each of these inaugurations. You know, the way Swami was coordinating the entire effort. He was writing letters back and forth to the devotees who were getting material, and was communicating to the people in Bukapatnam. Even though Swami was traveling sometimes, he was in Bangalore, he would write saying that this is how this has to be used, and procure this from there.
Yes, naturally, because you know the people who were financing the project were different from people who were involved in getting materials for the project, different from people who were managing the project. But overall, the CEO, if we can say so, was Swami, and so he had to coordinate. And as you said, it's amazing, though he was traveling all around the place, that is in South India at that time, he kept in constant touch with different people to ensure that the progress was on in all these constructions. Just like how he used to do even towards 1990s and 2000 also, toward whenever any new project was announced, Swami would be intimately and completely immersed in the details of the project. He would be updated. Yes, so the beginnings of what we saw even in our student days was there right from the 1940s itself, when Swami oversaw the construction of this public park, and yes, even the Prashantanilayam Mandir and the Patha Mandir before that.
You know, even when we were talking about this park, I was reminded the recent most musing which Venkatraman sir did He did about Mahatma Gandhi. And there he mentions of one of the incidents where he hears the news from this public park.
Oh, okay. You know, speaking of Mahatma Gandhi, last satsang I think we discussed about how Swami on 30th of January 1948 kept inside his room and indicated that a Mahatma had left.
Right.
And the Mahatma happened to be Mahatma Gandhi. You know, on the same day, 30th of January, something else happened, something very interesting. This happened to Miss M.L. Leela, another devotee of Bhagwan. She was located in Madras at that time.
Right.
And she recounts that on the 30th of January, she was very saddened when she got to know. Madras being a city, they get the news faster. Right. Puttaparthi got to know only 2 days later. But she was very saddened when she got to know that Mahatma Gandhi had passed away, the father of the nation had died. She began to shed tears. And she says that once she began to shed tears, those tears would not stop. I mean, it was no longer emotion and sentiment and sorrow. It was some kind of a problem and the eyes were continuously shedding tears and they became swollen and red. By the evening, by the next day, her eyes were very swollen, very painful, they were red. And in fact, they say that it was a kind of an infection that had set in.
Yeah.
So, when this infection had set in, they did not know what happened. I mean, what started off as emotion seemed to have become a disease. They had no idea, but even before they could go to the doctor, they receive a letter at home. And this letter is from Swami. And can you believe it? It has been written almost a week before. That is somewhere on 23rd or 24th of January. A week before the 30th of January. And in that Swami writes to the father of Leela, saying that, I know that your daughter is suffering from such and such an eye pain. I shall be going to Kuppam in February. And you know, we spoke about it last week.
Right.
How Swami attended the wedding of,
Vijay Kumari.
Vijay Kumari, yes, at Kuppam. So, Swami says, you come there, I will be there in Kuppam on the 22nd. So, 23rd, if you can come to Kuppam, I will take care, don't worry about the eyes of Leela. And so, they are so thrilled at this Leela of the Lord. And so, she bears with it. Huh? She suffers for almost a fortnight.
Okay.
And then, they leave for Kuppam. And when they reach Kuppam, it is the 23rd of February, as Swami had told them, she runs straight and falls at Swami's feet because the pain is unbearable and she has been suffering. Her eyes are still swollen and red. Swami instantly blesses her and materializes vibhuti, which she says had the iodoform smell, you know, that medicinal smell it had. And Swami applies it on her eyelids and then gives her a few jasmine flowers and tells her to place them on her eyes for a few hours. By the end of that day, all the swelling is subsided, the eye is back to its white color, the tears have stopped, and she is cured.
I mean, the way she narrates, it's so beautiful because she says that she's been having that pain for a few days, and when she comes and touches Swami's feet, the pain vanishes first.
Correct.
The swelling is still there, and as you said, you know, Swami gives those jasmine flowers with the instruction that tie it around your eye and don't take it off till you reach Madras.
Huh.
So all through that train journey, she's having that
jasmine flower,
you know, patched up to her eye. And there, after reaching the station, they remove it and they find that the eye is absolutely normal and her sight is back.
Some of the jasmine flower seems to be Swami's favorite, right? If I remember right, even when the current warden of the Vrindavan hostel, when he had his acid fall in his eyes, did Swami give him also a jasmine flower sometime?
No, was it
only vibhuti? Because I remember reading in, I think, the book Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Murfitt, some other person also who had a problem in the eyes, and I forget what is the problem now, whether it was an infection or whether it was a swelling, but Swami gives a bandage in which he places jasmine flowers and tells him to tie the bandage around his eyes for a few hours, after which the eyes are fine. So, for some reason, just like Lord Krishna picked the flute, it looks like when it comes to eye problems, Swami has some kind of liking toward the jasmine flowers.
You know, even as you say this and you mentioned Ravik Master, I'm just reminded of something which he said when they were students. There were a few boys who felt that they were very short.
Okay.
And you know, that was something which was always in them, that they're not tall, as tall as the other boys. So one day, when Swami had come to the hostel, I think when they were, Swami was with the boys, Swami asked, who are all the short boys in the class?
Hmm.
So when all these boys came forward, Swami materialized a small, a peda kind of a sweet.
Okay.
You know, a milk sweet.
A barfi sweet. Huh.
Okay. And Swami gave it to the warden. And Swami said, every day, mix a bit of this in milk, hot milk, and give it to these boys.
So they'll grow tall?
Yeah.
And was Ravi Kumar sir one among those recipients?
Yes, he was one of those. And he said after about a week, all of them grew at least 1 or 2 inches.
Oh, so the it's amazing because when we see Ravi Kumar sir today, he's still on the slightly shorter side.
Right.
But it's amazing.
But you know, I mean, what strikes me is it doesn't matter what Swami gives and, you know, the what is the remedy which Swami is suggesting because he's already decided to give the cure.
Okay.
And I think it's just a matter of, as we have said before, so that it can give people like us joy to narrate and listen to such things. That Swami does it in different many ways.
And you know, having the chance to receive that sweet which Swami materialized, I'm sure all those boys whom you said were feeling bad that they are short would have felt thrilled and counted their being short as a blessing in itself. And that is what the Lord's touch does, right, Prem? In the sense, when the Lord touches us, everything, when the Lord, anything, even an apparent disadvantage, becomes a blessing. And that is the alchemist's touch, the magical touch of the Lord.
Definitely. I mean, and as students, we've always seen it. The shorter ones, the tallest ones,
the fattest ones
all get noticed so very easily.
Yeah, I remember I used to also feel how good if I had been fat. You know, because Swami would instantly spot and call out, a pakoda, a bonda. You know, or if you are tall, a coconut tree, giraffe. You know, all those whom we normally considered as abnormal were blessed. So, in fact, the normal ones like us would often pine to become abnormal in some way so that we get recognition from the Lord. Rightly, as you said. You know, we were speaking last week about the wedding at Kuppam. Possibly that was the first wedding that Swami...
Before we move forward, there was another interesting insight into that episode which you narrated.
Hmm.
The interesting thing about the letter which they received saying, asking them to come to Kuppam was written 1 week before Mahatma Gandhi passed away.
Yeah, that's exactly. I think you said it.
Okay. I think
yes, on the 23rd or 24th of Jan, that was the letter dated. It had reached a week before even Mahatma Gandhi was assassinated.
Right.
So, yes... Swami's omnipresence and omniscience shown there. So yes, this marriage at Kuppam concluded. After that came another marriage, and this was possibly, I think it's confirmed that this is the first ever marriage that Swami performed in Puttaparthi,
okay,
in the Pathamandiram. And this was between the daughter of Narayan Sharma, that is Shanta, and P.S. Krishnamurti, who was the brother to the Karnam Kamalamma.
Okay, the second...
The second wife of the Karnam. You know, we spoke of how Karnam Kamalamma and Karnam Subbamma together donated the land for the Pathamandiram in 1945. Now, this is 1948, 3 years down the line. We also spoke about how the number of people coming to Swami increased and the first visitors were from Bangalore. And one of the first few visitors that we spoke about in that satsang was Karnam Kamalamma's brother, P.S. Krishnamurti,
right,
who came from Bangalore along with the hosts, his hosts at Bangalore. He used to stay with somebody else, and that happened to be Narayan Sharma.
Right.
Narayan Sharma's wife and his daughter Shanta.
Oh, okay, is it the same person whom you mentioned that Swami said that he's going to die soon or something like that?
Yes, yes. You know, in fact, Narayan Sharma that we're speaking about, it's a recap, and I don't mind recapping, it's so wonderful. This Narayan Sharma, when he came to know about his wife's and daughter's devotion towards Swami, he did not like it because he did not want to come.
Okay.
In fact, when P.S. Krishnamurti, that is Karnam Kamalamma's brother, mm-hmm, when he first came to Puttaparthi, he came only along with Narayan Sharma's wife and his daughter Shanta.
Okay.
And when he had come, Swami had told them that, don't worry, your husband will also be coming soon, which they did not believe. Which the mother and daughter did not believe because they knew that this...
seemed likely.
Yeah, he's an atheist and he doesn't believe in all these babas and stuff. But apparently, within a few days, he arrives. Mm-hmm. Narayan Sharma arrives and Swami takes a walk along with him, only with Narayan Sharma. And takes him to Chitravati. tells him to look into the waters of Chitravati. And when he looks into the water, he is simply stunned because he sees the Dashavatar. Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narahari, all the 10 avatars of Lord Vishnu. And finally when it comes to Kalki, he sees the man on the horse having a halo of hair. And he sees Swami there and he is stunned and he falls unconscious almost with that vision. And that is when he immediately turns after that and falls at Swami's feet and accepts him as his Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami tells him at that time that you do not have a lot of life left. Because of which he says that then I want to spend as much as possible with you, Swami. And then Swami promises him that I will take care of your daughter Shanta like my own daughter. Mm-hmm. That is a promise Swami gives. And that is the promise that Swami upheld when he performed the marriage of Shanta. Imagine, Swami was just a boy of 17 when he gave the promise. So he took up, I mean, at the age of 14, Swami took up the promise of fathering the whole world. So what is one girl there? So when he was 17, he had given this promise. You know, interestingly, whenever after that, when this Krishnamurti, that is the brother of Karanam Kamalamma, used to visit Parthi along with his hosts, Swami would always tease him, husband and wife have come, husband and wife have come, referring to Krishnamurti and Shanta. And finally in 1948, Swami blessed both these to get married. I mean, Shanta with Krishnamurti. I think at that time, Shanta was about 15 years of age. Krishnamurti was in his early 20s. And so that was the first wedding that Swami performed in 1948. I think that was on the 4th of March 1948.
Okay. I mean, it's really interesting, especially the reference that you made to a 17-year-old person trying to tell somebody that I'm going to take care of your family after you. I really wonder what kind of a feeling that would have left them with. You know, Swami is looking so tender. Swami, you have no idea what Swami is. You know, now when we look back, we say that Swami said it, and of course, you know, Swami kept his word. But then to receive a word like this from somebody who's just a mere teenager,
who's almost your child's age.
Exactly.
In fact, Swami also, you know, before telling that Narayan Sharma would not be living for a long time after this, he had in fact told his wife that, you know, you will not have any more children.
Mm-hmm.
She must have wondered at that time. It is natural because her husband is going to pass away. But Swami told her that you always sought a son, right? You can treat me as your son. Swami gave her that promise. Imagine, he is promised to be the father of her daughter, but he has promised to be a son to her. And only the Lord can do this. Be a son, be a daughter, be a mother. You know, how many of us have called Swami as Mother Sai? How many have treated him as a father? Because God is everything. God can be everything and only God can be everything. And as you rightly said, it would have been quite amazing for Narayan Sharma, right, but he accepted it.
Reading about the Kuppam family, there we spoke about one of Vijay Kumari's brothers who accompanies Swami to Kuppam. You know, Swami runs away behind the deers and the peacocks.
Hmm.
You know, he was telling when they first came to Swami, and this person, Mr. Krishna Kumar, I think, if I'm not wrong, right?
Yes, Krishna Kumar.
So he says when
Ram
he comes,
Kumar and Krishna Kumar.
Right. Swami used to call one boy Murti and the other Amba. So this Krishna Kumar was the person whom Swami used to call Murti.
Okay.
And Swami, interestingly, Swami said, Krishna Kumar is such a big name, I have only two alphabets, Sai Baba. So I'm going to call you Murti. That's what Swami said. You know, he was telling when they first came to Parthi, and Swami was standing at the gates or whatever, in the banks of Chitravati, waiting for this whole retinue which is coming from Kuppam for the first time. When he saw Swami for the first time, you know, the first thought which came across him is, if this boy itself is so attractive and so beautiful, how will the guru who is the master of this ashram be?
Oh, he thought that.
He thought that Swami was the disciple of the elderly and old sage-like guru who must be the person running the ashram. You know, and I mean, just got reminded of that when you said 17-year-old boy who's giving this assurance that I'll take care of your family.
Yes, so that was how the wedding of Shanta and Krishnamurti was performed. In fact, Swami, we spoke about how during Dasara, Swami would deck himself with different ornaments like the Devi.
Right. The devotees would give their jewelry and...
Yes, to Swami, and And some of the devotees even left some of the jewelry with Swami, telling that this is for Swami. And once Swami has worn it, how can we mere mortals wear it? So they considered it as their honor to give it to Swami. Some of that jewelry Swami gave to the bride to wear.
Okay.
And then he materialized a Mangalsutra. After that, how many weddings Swami has performed and how many times Swami has materialized Mangalsutra. Here also, this was probably the first ever recorded, not probably, definitely the first ever recorded instance where Swami materialized the Mangalsutra for a wedding that he was performing. And that was how the wedding was performed. It gives rise to one more thought, you know. 4-5 years ago, in the 1944, when people from Bangalore first came, you know, Swami, as I said, Swami used to joke, saying that husband, wife have come.
Right.
It all appeared like a joke back then. But, you know, no word of the Lord is in jest. Nothing is ever a joke. Because, as they say, every word is a Veda in itself. So, that gives again a reinforcement for all of us that every word of the Lord is so powerful, is so full of meaning. Though we may not understand it at this time, let us not take anything as a joke or as just a casual remark. Because as our former controller of examinations, Professor Nanjundaya Garu, put it, if Swami tells you something seriously, pay attention. If he says something casually, note it down and forever enshrine it in your heart. Because most of the most significant things, Swami has just made it as passing remarks. And they have turned out to be true. So, well, that was the marriage that took place. And after that, as I said, many marriages Swami has performed. Another marriage, probably the second one, was of a person by name Chinna Babaya. And you know, Chinna Babaya was supposed to get married to a woman whom he felt was dark and not up to his standard, you know, in fairness. He was very fair and handsome and she was not. Swami chastised him and told him that that was not right. It is not the color of the skin that matters, and told him that they would be the perfect couple. And that is how he agreed to marry that girl, and Swami performed that wedding. But the relatives of this Chinna Babaya, they could not stand the fact that somebody in their family was getting married not by a Brahmin priest, but by some Bhattraju. Again, you know, the caste of Swami came into question. And they were horrified when they saw the groom fall at the feet of Swami. Somebody younger than him, he's falling at, and somebody was of a lower caste. So they were just shocked. They left in a huff. And in fact, 10 days later they were returning. They had come with an kind of, you know, evil plan. They had brought along with them sackfuls of leaves of a particular plant, which causes a terrible itching sensation if it touches your skin.
Okay.
Their plan was, they will dump all these leaves onto Swami, and if he's got, nothing should affect him. But their plan got disrupted because on the way, suddenly their cart upturned and all the leaves fell off. Luckily, nothing on them, and they were blown away by the wind. But they received some slight injuries, and when they came to Puttaparthi, Swami meets them, greets them, makes them comfortable, gets food served to all of them, very lovingly takes care of them, and then says, you know, I heard that your cart had upturned. You must have lost everything that you brought to offer to me, right? He said it in such a positive light that all of them were shamed into silence, and they actually fell at his feet. And as Chinna Babaya reveals in the interview, that after that day, all of them began to accept Swami as the Lord, and they were very repentant for what they had planned. You know, again, it goes to show that if you plan to give something positive to the Lord, you get back something positive. Plan to give something negative to the Lord, you get back something negative.
Right, I think this can also be enlarged to entire life also. You know, what Swami says is what you send forth comes back to you. That's something which Swami has always told us, and you know, I think we've had satsangs about this before, where what you think reflects back to you, and what it always comes back, it always comes around.
What goes around comes around.
Right.
Well, another interesting episode of this period, we cannot say it as an episode because many people have reported this, you know, was when Swami would go to Chitravati, he would often point to the Kalpavruksha tree at the top of the hillock, which was at the border of the river Chitravati, about 200-300 yards away from the actual river. And Swami would say, look up there. And the minute they look up, suddenly Swami is not there by their side. He has vanished. And they start walking and he's already sitting on top of the tree. And on many occasions, Swami granted some of the most phenomenal experiences to these devotees. One such episode has been recorded in the product, the Sai Blossom product called the Advent. And I think, Prem, we should better play the audio directly from that beautiful video product.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, this is a narration of Mrs. Vijay Kumari, the author of Anyatha Sharanam Nasti, because she was a witness. And in fact, we've heard some of these incidents even from Professor Jayalakshmi Gopinath.
Okay, the former warden of...
warden and principal of Anantapur campus. Because she was also a part of some of these groups which were taken to Chitravati and given these beautiful visions. So we listen to that particular clip from the Advent.
One day in 1947, we went with Swami to the Chitravati River. All of a sudden, he disappeared from our midst. We then heard his voice which said, "I am here on the hill and I am going to now show you all Surya Darshan, the vision of God as sun." We began to wonder. It is past 6 in the evening and the sun has already set. And now Swami is saying he would show us the sun. That was when we began to laugh. Just then we began to see a pink light behind Swami. Quickly pink turned into red and we began to feel very hot. The heat made us sweat profusely and was unbearable. At the same time, the scene we saw was beautiful, indeed beyond description. Finding the heat unbearable, we loudly complained, "Swami, it is too hot." He replied, "Is that so?" And then slowly the heat began to decrease when Swami suddenly announced, "I am now going to show you the moon." Even as he uttered those words, the sky behind him gradually began to turn silvery white and the air started to cool rapidly. Soon we began to feel very cold and started shivering. Our teeth began to chatter and we screamed, "Swami, it is too cold!" Taking pity on us, Swami made the chill disappear. After which he said, "I am now going to show all of you the third eye. Watch carefully and don't look here and there." As we stood there watching his full form, we suddenly saw only his face, huge in size, filling the entire sky. Even as we were watching all this with awe and wonder, an orifice appeared in between his eyebrows, from which flew giant sparks and huge flames. Instead of being lost in this extraordinary spectacle of divine glory, we now became very worried and anxious as we could see only Swami's face. We began to wonder, what has happened to Swami's body? Have the flames harmed Swami? That was the thought uppermost in our minds. Meanwhile, many people fell down and some even fainted, but I did not realize it then. Suddenly, in a flash, the entire spectacle came to an abrupt end. The sky was back to normal as if nothing had ever happened, while Swami was with us on the Chitravati sands. He then asked why some people had fallen down. We said that we did not know the reason. Swami then created sacred ash or vibhuti and applied it to everyone's forehead. Having done that, he said, "Come on, let us return to the mandir." We started walking back, but most of us were quite unsteady and wobbling. Ah, Back in the mandir, with much love, Swami said, "Today I have granted you the blessing of Trinetra Darshan, the vision of the third eye for which you all have been pining in many previous births. What I have shown you is not even 1/1000th of the full glory. And what little I showed made many of you to fall down, unable to bear the power of that sight." That was when some kind of normalcy started returning amongst us.
You know, there are many, many such accounts and narratives where Swami performed miracles which are variants of the one that we just heard, where Swami has given darshan as different forms of the Lord, where Swami has given darshan as brilliant ball of light of different colors. Some say it was yellow, some red, some say blue. So, different variants of this, and there are many such recorded instances, recorded in the sense in diaries of people and people's books. And invariably in all of them, we find this happening, that people are unable to contain either their awe or their joy or their fear or whatever it is, and they collapse unconscious. I remember one of our teachers making a reference saying that, you know, the light bulb, if it's a 40 watt bulb, in that if you pass a high surge of electricity, the bulb will burst. The filament in the bulb must be strong enough to bear the current that is going to pass through, and that is how it is even with Swami. The current of joy that he is capable of giving is so tremendously large. What we have to question is, are we capable enough filaments to be able to contain that surge of great joy that he has the capacity to give? Because he is the generator after all.
You know, one devotee was once sharing with us when we met him here in Prashant Nilayam.
Mm-hmm.
He used to come in the 60s. And that one particular trip when he had come, Swami had sent word that nobody should sleep in the open.
Okay.
He said everybody should sleep only in their rooms for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So this person too was given a room when he landed quite late in the evening. But since it was a little warmer in those days, he thought that I'll go out and sleep in my car. You know. So then people told him that, see, Swami has specifically advised that nobody should sleep in the open. So he waited till quite late in the night when nobody was around, so he could slip and go and sleep in his car. He said around 1 o'clock, he was woken up by some huge ball of light which was coming from the eastern corner, you know, in the ashram, not from the skies or something. So he was wondering what it is, and he said when he got up, he saw a huge figure, which is maybe to a height of a two-storied building, and when he looked carefully, it was actually a white horse on which Swami was sitting, and he was coming around the ashram. That was the vision that he had, and just like it happened to all these people, he passed out after that. And
Okay. And
the next morning Swami came and chastised him. I've sent word that nobody should sleep in the open. So of course he said that many times after that he tried sleeping in the open after it, but never had that again.
You know, we see that Swami himself has said that the first 16 of his years of his life will be Leela and the next 16 Mahima. So though Swami continued to do the things even later on, most of these, you know, phenomenal, shocking, awe-inspiring kind of miracles appeared to have occurred before Swami turned 32 years in the physical frame. After that it continued, but not in such a large quantity.
Right. Even if you look at Swami's transcorporeal journeys, you know, It continued till it even happens today. But I think in those years, as you said, till the 30 years of Swami's, life, Swami wanted people to notice it. That's why Swami would, even physically in his presence, he would pass out and he would go into a trance for 3 hours, 4 hours, and people would say that Vibhuti had come out of Swami's toe, or, you know, Vibhuti had come out of Swami's forehead. I think Swami was doing it, giving the devotees around him an opportunity to realize that
I think that is the right way to put it.
Time.
Rather than say that he did it more often then and less now, he gave blessing to humanity in such a manner that it would be recognized and seen more often then than now. Now also, one or two when they surface such miracles, we are so thrilled. But yes, so he knows what are the best reason for that. And that's why the phases of his life have been divided thus. And those were the days when he would give the devotees the opportunity and chance to see such things.
Right. Now, coming back to 1948, we spoke about the Sandur royal family, which
yes,
was beginning
in January.
To, right, beginning to get drawn to Swami. And the Queen first comes and meets Swami when Swami was staying in Bangalore.
Hmm.
And Swami invites both of them to Puttaparthi. So I think just around the time when the king and the queen were planning a visit to Prashandilyam, suddenly the Sandur king is called to Delhi. You know, we've spoken about the situation then where the...
All the kingdoms are being annexed into the
Indian... Right, into the Indian country which was just formed. So he was suddenly called to Delhi and he had to rush and they couldn't make that trip to Parthi.
In the beginning of February.
In the beginning of February. And that's when the queen sends word to Swami.
Hmm.
You know, thinking that it would be impolite not to let Swami know that they're not coming.
Mm-hmm.
So she sends a letter with a person saying that you go and directly hand it to Swami. And this person is traveling all the way from Bangalore to Puttaparthi.
Mm-hmm.
And when the bus in which this man is traveling is at Bukkapatnam, suddenly the bus is stopped and everybody in the bus start talking, you know, what happened, why is the bus stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Then he hears that people are telling that this is Sai Baba who is coming in the car who has stopped this bus. So when everybody look out and they're wondering why Swami has stopped the bus, and he sends word to the conductor of the bus saying that there is one person from carrying a letter from the Sandur Rani.
Mm.
He's traveling in this bus.
Mm-hmm.
Swami is asking for him.
Oh.
In this manner sitting there, how did Swami come to know? And he came to, he realized that Swami was actually leaving Parthi. He was going to Madras on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
And midway Swami had intercepted this bus so that he could, you know, call this man. And even before he could give the letter, Swami told this man that tell the queen it's okay. She can come whenever she finds time.
Wow.
You know, that's one incident which happened. And after that, I think a few months later, sometime in April, May, if I'm not wrong.
I think in March. In March itself. March itself, the Rani is able to visit.
Visit.
You know, what happens is, the Rani also, though she is more... having a greater tendency towards believing in Swami and becoming a devotee, she is also pulled because she had been a devotee of Shirdi Sai Baba. And even before that, she had a guru by name Hiralal Maharaj.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt like, you know, she is changing her gurus and gods, and she was not comfortable with that, though she was drawn to Swami. And that is when in Sandur, though she is not able to come to Puttaparthi and the Raja has gone to Delhi, when the Raja returns from Delhi, the Rani gets a dream in which she sees all, that is, all her gurus, that is Hiralal Maharaj, Shirdi Sai, and this latest, that is Sathya Sai, in a dream all becoming one, and all of them tell her, give her the same message that we are all the same, we are the one and the same. And she is very mightily impressed by the dream. She wakes up and shares it with her husband, but her husband is again an atheist. So, he is not much impressed by this dream. But nevertheless, as a king, a promise has been made on behalf of him also that we will be visiting. So, he also agrees to visit the Sai Baba of Puttaparthi. And that is how, you know, 1948 was a leap year. So, on the 29th of February, the Rani and the Raja, they visit Puttaparthi.
Okay.
And when they visit Puttaparthi, Swami materializes.
In fact, you know, the incident goes that they visit Puttaparthi even without informing. You know,
exactly.
The king decides this time not to let Swami know, and maybe he thought that let's see if, you know, Swami is prepared to receive them. And they're surprised because even as they come near the bank of Chitravati, they find that Swami is standing there waiting to receive the whole party.
With the welcome party. Exactly. And that impresses the king. Right, correct.
And when they go to the ashram, they find that Swami has made all arrangements
for their stay. Exactly. Thanks, Prem. And that is what actually impresses the king.
Right.
Impresses the king with, wow, how did he know? How did we know? Because we purposely made it a point not to let him know that we are coming. Imagine trying to make efforts not to let God know of something.
And surprising that they didn't, you know, understand that this test was not needed after Swami, what he did to that messenger, intercepting that bus in Bukkapatnam and, you know, letting him know that he already knew.
Yes, that's right. But I think, Prem, this is a problem that all of us face. You know, we have all experienced in our own way Swami's divinity, Swami's omnipresence, Swami's omniscience. And yet, when it comes to, as they say, the breaking point or the crunch time, when you need to hold on to your faith, at such points, we ourselves get, you know, confounded with doubts and we start shaking maybe a bit and maybe the faith all seems to vanish. It somehow happens and that is what Swami calls as the Maya. And so I think that is a lesson for all of us also. In spite of having seen what, who Swami is, what he is, we still forget who he is and talk about him as a reformer or as a great person or as a normal human being. I think that is, as you said, it's a warning for us to keep remembering who Swami is, and that in itself is a great sadhana. So yes, so when they visit, when they meet Swami, Swami materializes a locket for the Rani and for the Raja.
Right.
And now the Rani, the queen, you know, she believes in Swami. Look at this. She believes in Swami. She has accepted Swami. She is thrilled. And her dream, you know, has only reinforced the fact for her that all her masters are one and the same. And she gets a locket on which there is Lord Krishna. You know, a safe bet, because I feel 99.99% of the Hindus believe in Lord Krishna. They have no problems in accepting Krishna as the Lord. She gets it. And the king, you know, who is still, he's impressed. He has respect and regard for Swami because he sees how much Swami has taken care to make arrangements for them, not knowing anything about their visit also. So he has great regard for Swami, but he doesn't take Swami to be the Lord and God or his guru or anything. And for him, Swami materializes a locket, locket in which there is both Shirdi Sai and Swami's own bust. So the Raja accepts it reverentially because Swami is giving it. And with that, Swami also assures the king, telling him that I know these are tough times for your kingdom, but don't worry, everything will work out fine. And it is with this assurance that Swami sends back the king and the queen right back to Sandur.
But another interesting thing which Swami gives them is, one day I think Swami calls the queen and...
This incident, Prem, happens later. In February, they return back to Sandur.
Okay.
And in March, the Rani alone, this time,
okay,
along with her in-laws. Because
right,
last time, the Rani and Raja have come, naturally they would have gone back and the Rani would have told the stories to her in-laws. And now the in-laws, that is the Raja's parents, are interested, are curious about Swami. And so the in-laws and the Rani in March, they visit Puttaparthi.
Okay, okay. So I think that's the time when Swami gives them this. I think one day Swami calls the queen and tells her that he wants to give her something.
Mm-hmm.
And as the tradition those days, you know, women, they don't receive anything from divine personages with a hand. So she puts out the pallu of her sari. You know, that's how you receive a gift from elders and from divine people. So she puts out her pallu and Swami says, no, show your hand.
Okay.
So when she puts out her hand, Swami puts something in her hand and closes her hand.
Mm.
And when Swami does that, she feels a shock running through her body. And she realizes that Swami has given her something very, very powerful. You know, shock vibration goes through her entire body, and when she opens her hand, she finds in it a small idol of Subramanya. And Subramanya happens to be the family deity of the Sandur royal family.
Wow.
You know, and that's one very strong gift which Swami gives during that visit, as you corrected me.
Yes, and this electrifying experience is something that the Rani is just unable to forget. And you know, when it comes to people and their faith in Swami, I feel that once you have had an experience with Swami, yes, of course, as I said, in times of distress and trouble, Maya makes us forget and makes us shake in our faith. But nobody can take away from us the faith that Swami is the Lord. Swami is our God, because you have personally experienced it. How do you explain it? So after this experience, the Rani is convinced. She is so thrilled. And as you said, adding to the fact was the idol of Lord Subramanya, which happens to be the family deity of the Rani. And so, it's with great thrill, you know, that after this visit in March, in fact, I think the Rani makes two visits in March, which is quite a distance from Sandur in Karnataka to Puttaparthi in Andhra Pradesh. It was quite a distance, but she makes two visits in March and she's so thrilled by it. And this actually sets the ball rolling for what we shall see later on as Swami's visit to the kingdom of Sandur. But in the meanwhile, you know, this was in March and April, and in May, Swami makes a visit to Madikeri or Coorg, the hill station district in Karnataka. In fact, it is said that, it is not said that, I mean, it is a fact that it is so hilly, this district of Coorg, that it is the only district in Karnataka without the railways. You can't have railway tracks running up and down the hill, so it's connected only by road and air.
Mm-hmm.
There are no railway tracks in this district. And Swami visited the district of Coorg, and Coorg district also happens to be the place where our Srimati Sakamma has her coffee estates. So Swami took some time out to visit her coffee estates. And he also visited the famous Shiva Samudram Falls during this visit. And that was about May. I think it's a perfect time to, when in the peak of summer, you go to a hill station and bless the devotees there. So that is what happened in May. And then we come to June. You know, June is again very significant because this was the time when Swami visited the kingdom of Sandur.
Right.
But before that, you know, there are some diary entries by different people, and there's one Leela Rao.
Mm-hmm.
There's one Leela Rao who has recorded in detail what happened on a day-to-day basis in the May and June of 1948. And reading her diary entries, one is very impressed, Prem. You know, we have often spoke about how Swami was so close and Swami was so intimate, Swami was so different, he was so much human-like rather than being God-like. But reading her diary entries, one doesn't get that impression at all. You know, the feeling that she says, my Lord told me to do this, my Lord came for darshan. Today I had darshan after I had my bath. Today I was so blessed because I had darshan even before my bath. The kind of feelings that a devotee, say in 1980s or 1990s, would exude, those were the feelings she exuded even in 1948, when we all think that, you know, Swami was just like one amongst the others because the crowd there was hardly 100, 200 people. But even back then, her diary entries show this. Isn't it so amazing?
Right, you know, in the later years, maybe devotees would have said Swami looked in our direction. But you know, the reverence was the same, as you pointed out, because she writes there that Swami came and stood on my hold all. Today Swami came and sat on my bedding. And you know, today I was lucky to have darshan of Swami even before going for bath, as you know, pointed out. Because the reverence was the same, you know, the incidents which gave them happiness were different because of the proximity and because of the small crowd. But the way they looked at Swami and, you know, the joy which they felt, Swami asked us to sing today, it was not a casual approach, as one might imagine, that, you know, the proximity gave them.
Correct. And, you know, if you read some more entries, you can easily identify. I'll tell you one, Prem, I'm sure you'll be able to identify with it. Like, she arranges next to her bedding a special seat and places a brand new sari on it, hoping that Swami will come and sit on it, and waiting for the day when Swami will come and sit. She watches when Swami goes and sits on the others, and she's waiting for her turn. I mean, is it not similar, a similar situation when what we faced when we held out trays to Swami, or a photograph for him to bless, or a letter for him to take? It's so similar, right? I mean, waiting for the Lord to come and bless. In fact, she records one or two very interesting episodes. I mean, I don't know the significance as such, but it's so beautiful. She says, one day, Swami came and picked up a book. And Swami leafed through it and said, oh my God, this is a German dictionary. And it was indeed a dictionary from English to German.
Okay.
Fantastic, right? I mean, 1948, a German dictionary had found its way to Puttaparthi, which means definitely somebody of German origin or somebody who knew German, wanting to know German, was here in Parthi. And another day, you know, Swami opens a packet of the provisions, puts something in his mouth and says, this is sugar. So sweet. Small incidents. And you know, Swami would spend time going around, finding out somebody was sick there, giving some medicines. And on another day, he would go pick up a newspaper that had arrived, look at some of the topics there and start discussing about that.
And one thing which he narrates is when Swami would sit and everybody would sit around, Swami would talk about his visits
to different places.
To different places, to Bangalore, to
Karur, where he gave his first discourse. Yes, Swami would relive that. Swami would tell stories. Swami would sing songs. In fact, she records that one famous song is there, you know, Ramanannu Brovara.
Right.
Swami modified it into a new song, which was Baba Nannu Brovara, which happens to be the favorite of Leela Rao. And Baba Nannu Brovara is like a plea to Swami, telling him to inquire from me or talk to me That is a kind of a song.
These are very beautiful things, you know, because when Swami, when we say that Swami spoke to them about their travels, Swami spoke to them about what he did, you know, this was something which Swami used to do till the very end, because I remember as students, when we would sit in the bhajan hall, Swami would come and talk to us about the water project, the improvements which are being made. I remember the Godavari water project. We first heard it from Swami. You know, we had no clue that Swami was doing a water project in Godavari. You know, one day in the morning, Swami came in the bhajan hall and he started speaking about the project. And that's when we realized that, oh, Swami is taking up a project like this. You know, it was a way by which Swami related to devotees around, you know, made them feel that
they are part of his family.
You are my family. Because he would share with them what is happening in his life. You know, if you could put it that way.
Really, you know, my brother Amay, he says about one amazing thing when Swami called him and his mother for an interview. Swami started talking to them about the then project, which was the Anantapur water project.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami went into great detail explaining all this to them. And Amay said that he was wondering, why is Swami telling all this to us? I mean, we have no as such involvement. There is no benefit that the project will get or Swami will get out of telling this to us. But one thing he says is, we definitely felt so close and intimate to Swami, because what is important to him, he is sharing with us, which makes us feel that we are also so important to him.
I think it's a very beautiful message that Swami is giving us, that if we want to feel close to Swami, that's what we have to do with Swami. You know, some of these devotees have this beautiful way of interacting with Swami, where they talk to Swami all that is happening in their life.
Yes.
And, you know, every single thing which is happening in their professional life, in their personal life, they just speak it to Swami. And I think that's a very beautiful way of, you know, relating to Swami.
I also remember a very common kind of message that we see in many Sai devotee homes.
Mm-hmm.
It says that Baba is the head of this house, a silent listener of every conversation, an unseen guest at every meal.
Right.
You know, it is so beautiful, because Swami himself encouraged us towards this. The way he interacted, when we read these diary entries of Leela Rao, we see that the way he interacted, the way he spent time, yes, nothing was mundane for him. Anything that is important to the devotees was important to him also. And that holds good even today. So as you said, this is a beautiful sadhana or a way of being in touch with Swami, that we can communicate with him, talk to him about our happinesses, our joys, our sorrows, and definitely he is listening and he will respond to us in a most beautiful way, and each of those responses will be experiences in themselves.
You know, one of the things which Swami tells a devotee is, you know, imagine that you have a phone connection to God and you're ringing it every day. That's your prayer. You know, you're trying to connect to that. And for a long, you'll hear the ringtone, but nobody will pick up. But don't give up. Keep trying. Because one day you will see that somebody on the other end will pick up and say, I love you too. That's the message that Swami gave. It's a beautiful thing where Swami is saying that never give up, because one day he's going to pick up and say, I mean, I know that you're calling.
You know, imagine when you say never give up, this Leela Rao records that she had a great desire that she, along with her mother, they wanted to perform Pad Puja for Swami. The elaborate ritual where, you know, you applied turmeric and haldi, turmeric and sandal paste to Swami's feet.
Right.
He puts his feet on a white cloth and the footprints are made, and they, you know, they worship Swami's feet with water, which is later taken as teertham.
Right.
With flowers and other things. Swami refuses, actually. You know, Swami says no and she feels very bad. In fact, she goes to record that also in her diary. Mm-hmm. That, you know, Swami refused, my Lord refused my worship today. It's not that daily she gets to do it. During that whole trip of 1.5 months, the one chance she sought. I mean, can you imagine? It was difficult. It was not as if that anybody who wanted to do Pada Puja could do. It was just like an interview. Nothing changed. In fact, I remember I think it was your classmates. His name was Venu Gopal.
Right.
When he once told Swami, he said, Swami, you know, access to you has reduced so much. You know, when Swami went into the car. He said, before we had so much access, today we don't have access. Swami, he said, replied to him that access nobody ever had. Access was always given. And even today, those who need the access are being given the access. So, it is not as if in the olden days, whoever came got a chance and therefore those of us who have come in late have missed. No, it is not like that. Nothing can ever be missed with Swami. whatever Swami has to give, definitely He'll give it to us. And whatever we cannot receive, we are not receiving. So there's nothing to feel bad about, feel sad about, or feel extra proud about that I received more than the other person. Everything is just His grace. And that is what Leela Rao, you know, realized, because Swami refused that Pada Puja. And when Swami refused that Pada Puja, she felt, oh God, what is this happening? And she noted it down in her diary. Can you believe it? Swami comes to her and tells, what are you writing? And she says, I am writing my diary, Swami. Swami tells her, you don't worry. I will come to you in Pune. Visit you in Pune. Pune was the place where she was from. So she said, Swami, where? Swami, you simply tell so many things, but you don't do. Then Swami said, what do you mean? That day when you were coming in the bus got spoiled, you had to get down, and then you had no way, suddenly a horse cart pulled up and you got into it, you remember? And Swami starts narrating so many things. Mm-hmm. And she's just shocked. I mean, this is not there anywhere, recorded nowhere in her diary or nothing, it's just in her distant memory. Swami tells all this and says, I know all this is happening. I'm there with you always, right? So, when I'm saying that I'm in Pune, I'm in Pune. And then, you know, she protests like any of us do later on. She says, no, Swami, not like this. You should not come to Pune like this. We don't want Swami in the omnipresent form. We want, Swami, I want you to come. It's not fair this way. Swami that time changes the topic. He changes of the topic, and that he is an expert at doing. You know, when he doesn't want to physically do something, he changes the topic. And later on, he allows the family to do Pada Puja also. So she does Pada Puja. She is so thrilled. She has just received this experience of Swami's omnipresence and omniscience. And in fact, in her diary, she notes down that day as the happiest day of her life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was beautiful going through her diary entries. Dear listeners, the time in our studio is 1:30 p.m. We'll be back. And when we are back, we will discuss about how Swami visited the kingdom of Sandur and some amazing happenings there. So don't go away anywhere. Here we'll be back after this short break. Till then, just enjoy the song. Thank you.
talking about Shirdi Baba. That song was about Swami and Shirdi Baba. And that was a connection which brought this family, the Sandur royal family, to Swami and a few other families which we're going to talk about later. But talking about this Sandur queen and king, we spoke of how they came to Swami first. And then came the visit of Swami to the Sandur palace. You know, Swami was invited and Swami accepted the invitation. June 17th, Swami visits the Sandur palace. And as soon as he enters, he's given the royal reception. Swami's, you know, Pada Puja is performed for Swami. And Swami is called inside. I think it's a new palace, right? From the description which is given, it looks like it's a new palace which the king and queen are going into, and Swami is invited. Because after going there, Swami actually asks for the pictures which are worshipped in the old palace to be come, and the new puja room is installed and Swami blesses it. That's one of the things which Swami does there. And Swami asks for the throne of the king to be brought to the palace.
Correct.
To the new palace. And in fact, the king invites Swami to sit on the throne and, you know, bless it. And Swami sits on the throne. But
I think that is a marked change that starts coming in.
Right.
Along with sitting on the throne of the palace, Swami also seats himself in the heart of the Maharaja. Exactly. Yashwant Rao Ghorpade that we discussed. Because after that, the Raja starts, you know, somehow believing and having faith in Swami.
And one of the standout incidents which happened in that Sandur visit was, one day it seems Swami was in the terrace when Swami calls the queen. And Swami again says that I want to give you something. And again she puts out a sari, you know, to receive the gift. Swami
says, she puts out her hand this time.
No, the same, she puts out the sari, and Swami says that no, the sari is not good enough. Get a thick towel.
Okay, okay.
That's what Swami says. So they go around and bring a thick Turkish towel.
Well, last time it was stretch out your hand.
Right.
This time it is
this
a towel.
Swami saying, no, this cloth is not enough. You bring a towel. Wondering what is Swami saying, get a towel. So then Swami materializes a 7-inch statue and puts it on the towel. And when she receives it, she finds that it's actually so hot. You know, if a statue is just made and
mold from molten metal,
it is removed from the mold, it's like that. It's hot, and she's wondering how did Swami even hold it in his hand before giving it. And it's a beautiful statue of, you know, Lord Krishna standing. And that again is, she says that it's a very strong vibration she receives from that statue. And the next morning, I think Swami installs that statue in the puja room and performs puja, the first puja. And I think for many, many years after that, the family continues to worship that statue.
And that was in June. In July, the kingdom of Sandur was annexed into the Indian Republic, into the, it was not a republic then, into the Indian country, into the nation. At this time, you know, Swami gave a very significant piece of advice to the Raja. He told him to invest and actually start a manganese industry. He told him that there are good manganese mines and ores available in the kingdom. So the king should start this manganese industry. See, you know, when he was a king, he had, just by the fact that he's a king, he had no problems in terms of finances.
Starting a new business wouldn't have been
a problem. He later on, this business was what sustained the whole family. In fact, to this day, the Sandur Manganese and Iron Ores, it's a public company that is listed. Almost 70% of the 75% of the shares are owned by the family, even to this day. And in fact,
town Sandur is named by, I mean, is known because of that manganese industry.
Exactly. Even if you Google Sandur, many of the first things that throw up are about Sandur Manganese and Sandur Iron Ores. It's not only a manganese ore now, even iron ores have been found. And in fact, the latest that I read on Google was Jindal. Jindal is one of the largest.
The power industry.
Yes, power and iron, steel, steel industry, Jindal Steel in India. And it's has a presence across the globe. And Jindal is planning to buy iron and iron ore especially from the Sandur Manganese and Iron Ores company, because they are finding it tough and it's more difficult to get it from the government owned ores, mines I mean. And therefore the company was planning to make some kind of investment into Sandur Manganese and Iron Ores, which means even to this day, which is almost say 65 years after Swami told the Maharaja to start the manganese industry, it is doing very well. And well, I just feel that is what Swami does even symbolically in our lives. He puts us in touch where we can mine out what is most valuable in us, which will stand by us in good stead throughout life.
And interestingly, you know, when we spoke about that Subramanya statue when Swami gave, one of the things which Swami told the Queen is that this will help you when you go to Delhi. And,
okay.
You know, she was very surprised to hear that from Swami, but, you know, when you see that actually their kingdom was becoming a part of Delhi right now, you know, in a sense, maybe that's what Swami meant. In fact, that was one of the things which Swami was constantly talking to the King about when he went visited to Sandur, asking him to stay calm through the whole process and guiding him. In fact, initially the King was quite apprehensive about starting this manganese thing because it was a step down for them. You know, though we are looking at it as a manganese factory.
From rulers, they are becoming business people.
Right. But, you know, as you pointed out, it turned out to be one of the life-saving decisions that they made in the end.
There have been many instances. Even, you know, I remember Professor Anil Kumar, who was Swami's translator. He also had to, you know, in a kind step down. He was the principal. And from principal, Swami told him to become a lecturer, which doesn't make logic. Because a principal post is much higher compared to the post of a lecturer. But if you ask Anil Kumar sir, he will tell it with great joy that was a step that brought him so much closer to God and so much closer to what he treasured in his heart. And after that he became Swami's translator and so many amazing things followed.
I think everybody, you know, even our Professor Nanjundia sir has actually came to Swami like that. When he was about to become the professor, he came and joined as a lecturer. And Mr. Habu, who was our first principal, he was the head of the department in the university there, and he came and became a school teacher here.
Yeah.
And you know, all of these, but he still will not recount this as step downs anyway.
I think in that way, you know, Swami knows what, you know, we need both. We need a step up transformer as well as a step down transformer for a proper transmission of electricity.
Right.
So too, I think for the transmission of this divine joy, Swami has to act as both, depending on the situation. Sometimes a step up, sometimes a step down. But what we have to keep in mind, that He is always a transformer, bringing about a transformation in our lives.
That's well put. And you know, going back to this visit to Sandur, another interesting event happened. You know, most of these kings, they used to have their own armies and their own security and all that. So the king had a Muslim AD camp. You know, that's like the head of personal security to, even today we have the AD camp to the president.
Prime minister and president.
The prime minister. So he was the AD camp to the king of Sandur, a person by name Captain Jabbar Sahib, who happened to be a Muslim.
Okay.
And understandably, he would have been a little uncomfortable with this whole family running around this young boy who's, you know, treated like some
a teenage Sai Baba.
Right, a divine guest. So he was very uncomfortable, and you know, even in those days Swami started giving personal interviews to visitors to the Sandur Palace and the rest of the family. So one day Swami called this Jabbar Sahib for an interview. Swami called him for a personal interview. And I think they had an improvised interview room where just a curtain was put across a certain room where Swami would call them inside and talk to them. So Swami calls this Jabbar Sahib captain, and when he comes in and he's closing the curtains, when he turns back, he sees that Swami is opening his robe and showing him something.
Unbuttoned his robe. Okay.
Unbuttoned his robe, and just on his chest are written the words in gold, Allahu Akbar in Urdu.
Wow. Allahu Akbar in gold and Urdu emblazoned against
on Swami's chest.
Wow.
And I think that was his moment of reckoning. So the moment he sees that, he realizes that this is no ordinary saint or sadhu who has come to visit the palace.
And once he is convinced, every other thing that he sees suddenly begins to make sense now. You know, he sees every member of the family is eager to take a picture with Swami. There are many photographs of the royal family of Sandur along with Swami. And Swami is on the throne while the rest of the family are around Swami. So I think for Captain Jabbar Sahib, after his personal experience with Swami, all this made sense. In fact, when he told this to his wife again was hesitant in accepting, and Jabbar Sahib didn't mind that. He just left it. But after a while, even she was curious to meet Swami. So many attempts were made finally, when she met Swami, Swami goes straight to her and materializes a locket for her. Right.
That's interesting because, you know, when Swami, she goes to Swami, I think Swami is staying in one of the devotees' house in Bangalore.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's introduced her as Captain Jabbar Sahib's wife. She's just sitting along with the devotees. And Swami comes out of that bhajan session, which is going, goes straight to her, materializes a locket, gives it to her, and comes back and sits and continues with the bhajans.
And later on, she develops a deadly malaria. You know, malaria at that time did not have an easy cure.
Right.
But with Swami's grace and blessings and the locket that she closes, keeps very close to her heart in every sense, you know, physically as well as in metaphysically. Her malaria is cured and she completely credits it to Swami's grace and blessings. And that is how Swami wins over the throne in the hearts of Captain Jabbar Sahib and his wife too. And then, you know, we are into July. July 1948 is important for all of us because this was a time when one monarch of literature, one literary giant who has been responsible as Swami's instruments in starting many things, came into proximity of the avatar. Yes, Professor Narayan Kasturi. It was in the July of 1948 that he came to Swami.
You know, it's very interesting, this particular trust with divinity which you're talking about, because, you know, we've mentioned so many characters, but as devotees who came much later, we have no idea whether these devotees were still coming or did they have important roles to play in the avataric mission. But, you know, Kasturi was one person who came way back in 1948, but he's somebody whom we refer to even today.
Exactly. And the way he came to Swami is also interesting. You know, in 1947, immediately after India won independence, he lost his son. And he lost his son, and that was a devastating blow in his life. He just could not bear that. And he was shocked. His wife was shocked. His mother was also shocked. His mother was there. She was also shocked. And they just did not know. You know, as Kasturi puts it in his book, Loving God, life seemed to lose all its meaning. They didn't know what else is there to live for. And he said that the fire that burnt in his heart as he lit the funeral pyre of his son is something unimaginable, and he thought that that would never be put out, that could never be quelled by anybody. And that was when a friend of his son, deceased son, came to him and said that, you know, there is one Swami. And he told him about Sathya Sai Baba, and he said, he is Lord incarnate and he will give you solace. And Kasturi just shoos him away. He gives him 3 vibhuti packets also, which Kasturi just throws it off and gives it to somebody else, saying that how can you ever quell this fire that is in my heart? I have worshipped so many gods, those gods have not done anything. What is the new Sai Baba that you are talking about? But you know, Kasturi was a member of the Ramakrishna Mission. And at the Ramakrishna Mission, one of the Swamis there, I forget his name, tells Kasturi that, don't worry, the same God who has caused this grievous wound to you will himself heal this wound for you. Oh. So he tells him that, and he listens to that, but he's not very keen on the Sai Baba. At the same time, he's unable to ignore the presence of Sai Baba in his life, because one of his erstwhile colleagues also comes to him, you know, and Mr. Iyer, this person, he comes to him and talks to him again about so much about Swami. And Kasturi is thinking, how come that, you know, in so many ways this Sai Baba is coming into my life? He did not like this Sai Baba because, you know, in Kannada, which is Kasturi's mother tongue, Sai means go and die. That is what you will tell somebody. Hey, hok Sai, you tell in Kannada, which means you go and die, don't bother me. So it's like a abuse. So he said that, you know, what name itself is such an abusive name. And he did not want, you know, basically he writes all this in Loving God to show how much of antagonism he had towards this. But this Mr. Iyer, you know, comes in, he was a little short in stature, and he says that, my name is Potti Iyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Potti means, in Telugu, it means dwarf.
Okay.
And this was a name that Swami used to call him by, calling him Potti Iyer, Potti Iyer. And Kasturi is shocked. How can a 60-year-old.
It's very derogatory.
be proud about a derogatory remark that a person who is one-third your age is making about you. And he's proud to be called by that also. In fact, he insists that everybody calls him Potti Iyer because that is a name given to him by Swami. So Kasturi considers him to be a person who got premature senility. He just writes him away. But then he sees that his daughter, you know, Kasturi sees that his daughter, Padma, is in love with the grandson of this Potti Iyer.
Okay.
So Potti Iyer has a son whose name is Parameshwara Iyer. And Parameshwara Iyer's son is the person whom Padma Kasturi has set her heart on. And so Kasturi is also eager to get this marriage fixed. But you know, when he is just considering approaching Parameshwara Iyer for his son's hand, Parameshwara Iyer comes and says, you know, your daughter is of marriageable age. And Kasturi says, yeah, okay. And he says, so therefore, let me find a perfect groom for you. You know, I have found a bride for my son.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, let me find a groom for your daughter. Oh, Kasturi is disappointed and he writes in his book, Loving God, that Padma is heartbroken because she had already, you know, pledged her heart to this son of Parameshwara Iyer. And the next day, not next day, maybe a few days later, Parameshwara Iyer comes running to Kasturi's home. What has happened? Parameshwara Iyer says that Swami came in his dream. And Swami has told him something because of which he has come. In fact, in his book, Kasturi writes, the mind plays tricks when the brain is asleep. You know, that's what he calls about his dream experience. Because he is unaware of the ways of working of Swami. And in the dream, Swami has told Parameshwara Iyer, you better come to my presence immediately. And when Parameshwara Iyer has gone to his presence, Swami has just lambasted him for trying to find a groom for Padma.
Okay.
And says that the perfect match for Padma is your son. Kasturi's daughter and Parameshwara Iyer's...
Oh, Swami tells Parameshwara Iyer.
Parameshwara Iyer.
Okay.
Parameshwara Iyer's son.
Right.
Potti Iyer is out of the scene now.
Okay.
Parameshwara Iyer is receiving it. And so he says that Parameshwara Iyer, your son should wed Kasturi's daughter.
Okay.
And Kasturi says, did he mention my daughter's name? Yes. Not only your daughter's name, he mentioned your name also. Kasturi is wonderstruck. And his first expression is, wow, this Baba is worth cultivating, you know. He is having practical uses. He is helping in this marriage. And that is how later on, you know, in July, Kasturi makes visit Swami first. I think this was almost a year later maybe that. In July 1948 itself, I'm sorry.
Right.
He visits Swami at Railway Commissioner's Bungalow.
Right. There's been Thiruvenkatam Shetty.
Yes. And that incident is also amazing.
Right. So that's when I think he meets Kasturi for the first time.
Yes, and Swami calls Kasturi for the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kasturi is wondering what Swami will speak to him, the first statement that Swami ever makes to Kasturi just bowls him over and he's actually confused totally.
Mm-hmm.
Swami tells him, you will write my Jeeva Charitra, you will be my biographer.
Right.
Wow, you know, even as I say it, I get goosebumps on my skin. It's so amazing, just imagine. A person who is criticizing Swami so far, who has no idea who this Sai Baba is told in his very first meeting that you will be the one who will write my biography. Oh my God, and today we are having this radio satsang on Satyam Shivam Sundaram, a name which has been coined by Sri N. Kasturi for Swami's biography.
And it's so beautiful, you know, because imagine that Kasturi was a professor of history. You know, essentially he was that. Of course, he did many things as a literary scholar. To him, this must have been the most enticing bait of being a historian of somebody whom he has already seen that, you know, he's no ordinary person because he's moving with the royalty and he's doing some phenomenal things. The idea of being a biographer to a person such as this would have been such an interesting and exciting bait for him.
Exactly. And so that was another landmark event as far as we devotees are concerned in 1948. The later months of 1948, that is from September to December onwards, you know, as such nothing notable in quotes happened because apart from Swami's birthday, of course, in November of 1948, throughout the other time, you know, there are people have recorded. In fact, it is recorded even in Kasturi's book, Ishwaramma, the Chosen Mother.
Chosen Mother, right.
That Swami became quite sick. Nobody knows what was the sickness. And in fact, if anybody made mention to that, Swami would brush it off and say, nothing, illness and sickness is only for the body, not to me. But you know, Swami's face became very sunken. Swami lost a lot of weight. And Swami spent most of those few months, 3 to 4 months almost, at Sakamma's home in Bangalore, recovering and recuperating.
There was also a change in the personality, that's what they note. Because Swami did not like doing what he was so excited about doing, you know. Till then, the narrative which you heard is, Swami is excited about going to Chitavati, and Swami is excited about, you know, we've spoken about how Swami would tie a swing and swing around, and the garland making and all that. Suddenly Swami didn't seem to have interest in things which earlier interested him. And even with food, Swami would hardly eat anything. And as you said, that's when Sakamma forcefully took him to Bangalore to stay there in his house. And that's why there's very little
in
account.
Her house, yeah.
In her house, in the Bull Temple Road, right?
Exactly,
in,
yeah.
Bangalore.
That's still there.
Is it? Okay. And that's why there's not much of accounts, but of course, a lot of people whom we're going to refer to later came to Swami and met Swami during that period when Swami stayed in Sakamma's house. But that's when, that's a very, very interesting phase.
You know, very, it might be startling actually to reveal that, and it is there in Ishwaramma, the Chosen Mother. In fact, one or two devotees have recorded in their diary that during this time, Swami even spoke about leaving his body and taking Mahasamadhi. And at that time they were shocked and they said, Swami, you can't do this. You know, they were unable to comprehend what would happen. And they almost were convinced that in 1948, Swami's avatarhood would come to an end. You know, Adi Shankara, Swami Vivekananda, all of them left very early. You know, Paramahamsa Yogananda lived maybe a little longer. But all others, you know, quite young they left, so they thought that would be the fate of Swami also. But then, you know, Swami himself assured them that nothing is going to happen as such.
Right,
and he would
that,
stay.
Kasturi writes in Ishwaramma, the Chosen Mother, that Sakamma and Sushilamma actually go and plead with Swami. They fall at his feet and they request him to extend
his avatar,
not to leave so early. That's when Swami...
We must be definitely grateful to those two women, because whether it was, they were the instruments whom Swami had chosen to make that request, and Swami acceded and stayed on till 2011 physically. It was amazing. So, with that we come to the close of 1948, and dear listeners, as we stated, the last 3-4 months, there's not much of thing recorded other than, of course, Swami visited Puttaparthi for his birthday in November, and it was again a grand affair. With all the things that we described about the previous birthday happening, there were the processions, there was the anointing, and there were bhajans, and there were ceremonies. Everything went on as we had described previously. But again, after that birthday celebration in 1948, Swami returned back to the home of Sakamma in Bangalore, where he rested and recovered till almost the January of 1949.
In fact, one of the things which Swami told during that period was, now, he said many of the avatars actually go through that period where the body, you know, all said and done, it's a physical frame. It doesn't have the ability to hold the power that it is actually holding. So Swami said, my body is going through a process of restructuring. And that's what was the period. And in fact, we had made mention of this even last week, where Swami was looking a little, you know, sick and famished during that period.
The body had become weak,
right.
And Swami stated, and it is there in Ishwaramma, the Chosen Mother, as you said, that this is a period when its body is preparing to uphold the grand tasks that the avatar has come to do. And oh my God, now naturally I think the body underwent a lovely preparation, because later on, even when we look at 65th birthday or 70th birthday or 75th birthday, Swami definitely looks at least 10 to 15 years younger than what his bodily age is. And hats off for that amazing preparation of 3-4 months that his body went through. And sure. With that, dear listeners, the time in our studio is now 2 p.m. Though it is not, you know, it is not, we just feel like going on and on, because Swami's glories and stories are so beautiful. But well, Brother Chandu is here, and So with our humble pranams and gratitude at Bhagwan's lotus feet, thanking him profusely for this beautiful opportunity to live and relive his life and share with all of us, we take leave and hear the song to conclude the satsang, the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
And dear listeners, as we leave you with this song, it is our duty to inform you the happy news that this 4th of November, the Radio Sai studio at Hyderabad is completing its 1 year anniversary, and to mark that, this Sunday, that is 3rd of November, after the morning bhajans, we will have a special live telecast from the studios of Hyderabad, our Radio Sai studios there. Devotees will be performing live programs on the Radio Sai Telugu stream. So do tune in to the Radio Sai Telugu stream after 10 o'clock and join us in celebrating the first year anniversary of the Radio Sai studios in Hyderabad. Leaving you with this song, this is Prem with Arvind at Team Radio Sai. Jai Sai Ram.
अखिल जगत के दाता साई,
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 शिरडी निवासी भगवान, शिरडी निवासी भगवान,
शिरडी निवासी भगवान,
दर्शन दो भगवान साई, दर्शन दो भगवान साई, कलिमल भंजन परम दया घन, कलिमल भंजन परम दया घन, करुणा निधे श्रीनिवासा, करुणा निधे पतिवासा, दर्शन दो भगवान साई,
दर्शन दो भगवान साई,
दर्शन दो भगवान साई,
दर्शन
अखिल जगत के दाता साई, शिरडी निवासी भगवान,
शिरडी निवासी भगवान,
दर्शन दो भगवान साईं
दर्शन दो भगवान
कलिमल भंजन परम दयाघन करुणानिधे पतिवासा वासी भगवान दर्शन दो भगवान साई दर्शन दो भगवान साई
दर्शन दो भगवान
अखिल जगत के दाता सा